Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 149 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. About 149, it's a prime number, which means you can't divide any other number into it. And so is its next odd neighbor, 151. And so is the number when you spell it backwards, 941. So I think this is going to be a prime episode. If you got anything to say to me, email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download the MP3 after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast aggregators. You can listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Remember that you'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. You can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information to donate via PayPal. If you want to make monthly donations, please go to patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Even a few dollars a month helps. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization that you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. And now for some feedback from Robert, received via email. I just listened to Eric Marola on Brzezinski's struggles, and it was not just great content, but I could hear it. Robert has written to me before complaining about the audio on some of the shows. Granted, this one was done before I contacted you, but still, it was just about perfect audio levels. I sure wish the one with Judy Mikovits would have been loud enough to hear. I just love her. Anyway, I'm going to be able to listen to some of the latest ones since we spoke, and if the levels are good on those, I will happily consider giving you a little monetary support. And as a little side note, Robert did donate via Patreon, so thanks, Robert. He also talked about Fakeologist, who actually interviewed me recently. I commented that Fakeologist was a little bit conspiratorial. He said, yes, he agreed with that, but I like to listen to a lot of different opinions and theories. I don't think it's possible to have my own educated opinion on anything if I don't have a wide variety of sources. Thanks again. We'll hopefully be in touch real soon. Thanks, Robert. I appreciate your feedback, and I appreciate the feedback from any and all of my listeners. Regarding audio quality, I know that it's been a bit of a problem. I don't have an audio engineer. I have committed that when I get a substantial number of donations on Patreon, I will contract with an audio engineer so that the quality improves. In the meantime, I'll do the best that I can. I'm trying to learn audio as I go along, doing my own editing, which is not terribly complicated, but getting the levels right so that it's possible to hear myself and the guest with equal volume is a lot more challenging than I think it should be. Perhaps I need better tools, or perhaps I need a proper engineer. Just to let you know that this week I was in Lisbon, Portugal, giving a talk at a legal and philosophy conference at the University of Lisbon on the criminalization of HIV, and I will talk more about this, my presentation, in the future. In fact, I plan to go through it because I think what I dredged up was very interesting. I've also had an article published criticizing the the only Ebola vaccine that's close to commercialization, and I also want to talk more about that. But for now, let's go to this week's very interesting interview.
Charles Ortleb was an early gay AIDS activist and writer, publisher. He published Christopher Street, Theater Week, and most famously, The New York Native, which ran from 1980 to 1997. It was pushed out of business at the same time that the new protease inhibitors, so-called wonder drugs, emerged around 1996. He also wrote the books Iron Peter, The Closing Argument, Truth to Power, and a collection of short stories, The Last Lovers on Earth, some of which were made into a film, and I'm sure I've only really touched the surface. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so when did you get involved in gay publishing in the New York scene?
Well, I was going to the University of Kansas and was in graduate school and had started to read about, you know, the gay movement that was taking place in New York City, and I thought that's where the action is. So I left grad school and moved to New York on Memorial Day in 1972, and within a matter of weeks, I was involved with the Gay Activist Alliance there, and I had become close friends with Arthur Bell, who was a fairly famous gay journalist who wrote for the Village Voice. And several months after, you know, meeting Arthur, I got involved with starting a publication called Out Magazine, which was like the first sort of gay literary magazine, and it folded after two issues. And I felt that I could pull it off if I ran the show, so I started my own publication called Christopher Street, which was a literary magazine in 1976. And Christopher Street was in business for a number of years, and we were having financial trouble, and we weren't able to get advertising, and I thought if we could just start a newspaper, we might be able to get more advertising. So that's why I started The Native in December of 1980.
And why a newspaper is more profitable? Because of things like classified ads back then?
Yeah. Yes, classified ads, and, you know, my literary publication was a monthly publication, so, you know, like bars and other gay businesses, you know, were more interested in advertising, and it was a bi-weekly at that point. It eventually became a weekly, mm-hmm. And anyway, it worked, but what I didn't know was that what was coming was that, you know, within a matter of months, you know, I would get a phone call that some weird disease had broken out in the city among gay men who had been to a bathhouse, and I asked the doctor to do a story on it, and he called, I believe he called either the health department or the CDC or both, and they basically said there was no there. That was like in May of 81.
And June of 81 is, I think, when Gottlieb published the first paper in, was it the CDC's MMWR or something?
Yes, and the Times did a story. I remember the night. I write about this in my book, Truth to Power. I had been working at the paper late on a Friday night, closing the paper, and got an early edition of the New York Times, and there, I think it was on the cover. Maybe it wasn't on the cover. It was inside, but it said, you know, mysterious illness striking homosexuals or something like that. And I was completely freaked out by it. I thought, oh, my God, what is this all about?
Right, and it was called Gay-Related Immune Deficiency, or GRID.
Eventually, yeah. I don't think in the first, you know, articles it referred to it that mm-hmm. way, but it quickly became, you know, gay-related immune deficiency or whatever, which should have been like, you know, a warning of the kind of paradigm that was, you know, coming down the pike.
Well, it's interesting that you said that you were told there was no there a month before there was a there. It's almost like some high bureaucrats had a meeting and said, okay, we're going to announce a new gay disease. They hadn't come up with a clever acronym yet. But I mean, it's not a very long time between them saying there's nothing there and there is something there.
You know, I think this is work for investigative historians.
Yes.
To go back and try to figure out, you know, who knew what when, because there are many books to be written about this, you mm-hmm. know, we want to see the books, basically, and we want to find paper trails and stuff like that. At the time, I was not skeptical about anything.
Right.
You know, I just wanted to know what is going on. And I would say that the first 2 years of our coverage of the epidemic, most of which was done by Dr. Larry Mass, was not skeptical. It was your typical newspaper medical stenography.
Rewriting the press release, basically.
Right. A bright medically or scientifically oriented person translates, you know, press releases into more readable prose.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like somebody who's translating a language. You got this foreign language, medicalese, and you need an expert to translate that into English, but it's just a translation. There's no interpretation, right? It's like a literal translation of a poem from another language that has no feeling of a poem, because that's all it was, word by word translation.
And there's no skepticism. There's no critique. There are no serious questions, because this is sort of the one area of reporting where people, you know, don't doubt authority. They're just the assumption is, in science and medicine, it's all good intentions, it's all good faith.
Right.
What they say is always true. They would never lie about such important things. And I was, thinking along those lines in the first couple of years. I didn't really doubt that the CDC was telling the truth, But then we started catching them in, a few lies. And then I started to wonder, and I started doing more reading. And I read this amazing book called Betrayers of the Truth by Nicholas Wade and William Broad. And the book is about how endemic fraud isn't science. And it opened my eyes. I mean, I just never been thinking along those lines.
Well, yeah, how did doctors, who have been one of the highest paid professions, get to into a position where it's believed that money plays no role, money or power plays no role in their decision-making? Doesn't really make sense, does it?
I think people are afraid to question their doctors. Mm-hmm. And, they need to trust somebody in the world. And if you can't trust your doctor, who can you trust?
And do you think that for gay men, having a caring profession, somebody who said that they were going to look after you, you're coming in sick, you might have AIDS, I'm going to look after you. Do you think there was some kind of feeling like, this is an acceptance that I've wanted my entire life? I've always felt excluded from society, and now here's somebody holding my hand and giving me a pill.
I think you're missing an existential element here,
okay.
Which is in those years, it was sheer terror 24/7.
Right.
People just, couldn't think straight. They were just, some doctors were afraid to even go near the patients.
So they may be not holding the hands, but still, if you're terrified, like I've sort of felt this myself. I've never been that ill, but if I'm really, really sick and feeling like I'm going to die, even though obviously not, if somebody just talks to me nicely and shows some caring, I feel a whole lot better, right? And was that, gay men have been excluded from society, and now you've got this new profession of AIDS specialists who are saying, we're going to help you, we're going to look after you.
Right. There was no doubt that they were going to be helped. I mean, and anyone that was kind enough to treat them, was trusted.
Yes.
And, and that's the way it was, right up through the announcement of what the government thought the cause of AIDS was and what, the treatment would be.
Right. When did the New York Native start getting a little bit more skeptical, and what were the issues that started to trigger you that everything wasn't quite as controlled?
Without getting into too many complications, I caught Don Francis, who was a bigwig in AIDS research, lying about something. And that's when I said, wait a minute, that's not part of the program. Why are you guys lying? And it was about some testing that they had done. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And we started writing I started writing sort of critical editorials, questioning the CDC. I wrote an editorial questioning the integrity of Robert Gallo and Myron Essex. And we basically started getting the cold shoulder from the CDC. They wouldn't even talk to us anymore. I mean, they loved us in the first years of the epidemic because right. they thought that we were a reliable vehicle for information, that we would, you know, that they would tell us what's going on and we would tell our readers. And, you know, they weren't counting on the paper or me being, you know, becoming skeptical and becoming investigative. Mm-hmm. And as you know, eventually John Lauritsen started writing for us.
Yes, I've interviewed John. I know him fairly well.
You know, and John introduced Peter Duisberg mm-hmm. to the world. You know, and Peter really opened up my eyes and the eyes of our readers mm-hmm. that, you know, that something was very, very wrong. And we increasingly became, you know, sort of newspaper non grata, if that's an expression, to the establishment and to the gay community, because the gay community wanted to believe that everything was working out.
Yeah.
You know, I've always said that the gay community kind of made a pact with the devil when they decided to go along with everything that the CDC was saying about AIDS. And they did it under some duress because the AIDS activists, you know, became sort of an arm of the CDC.
Right, and but it wasn't just duress because presumably they also started to realize, like some, not the community itself, but some of the leaders of the community started to realize that there was money from the drug companies if they told a story that the drug companies wanted put forwards.
Yeah, I mean, there was sort of a small group of people that were sort of running the activist show. And,
yes.
You know, and they were kind of in bed eventually with the pharmaceutical companies insofar as the pharmaceutical companies were giving money to the activists, and then the activists were basically, supporting the conventional wisdom. By the way, I knew there was something wrong with ACT UP the day that I met Peter Duisberg in person, because it was a beautiful summer's day, I think, and there was this presidential commission on AIDS that Duisberg was supposed to speak at, and I remember vividly how when Peter got up to give his speech, and this is early on in AIDS activism,
right.
The AIDS activists got up to boo him.
Before he'd spoken.
And I thought, what is going on here? You know what I mean? These people are supposedly, you know, trying to get more money, you know, for research, but they're doing something else here. They're trying to silence any critical thinking that's mm-hmm. going on. And that really bothered me. And I also watched, you know, when Peter got up to speak at this at this conference, Matilda Krim, who, you know, ran AMFAR,
right.
made a point of getting up. She was sitting next to him, I think, or on the panel, and she got up and walked out of the room when he began to speak.
Wow.
And so it was really a very dramatic moment. And I was absolutely fascinated by Peter. I thought he was one of the smartest people and funniest people I'd ever met. I thought he was brilliant. I could not understand why such a intelligent, accomplished scientist was being treated like this.
I agree with you on both points. He's not only smart, he's also extremely funny.
No, I mean he could do a stand-up comedy routine in science. He's really, you know, he's really amazing. And so we became, you know, we helped promote Peter's ideas. I think John did, you know, several interviews with him. I think I called Peter a lot, you know, and we watched as the scientific establishment basically went to work on him. You know,
yes.
his career was destroyed.
Yeah, they haven't finished yet. He's has a lab at UC Berkeley. He can't have graduate students because anybody who's a graduate student for Peter Duisberg basically isn't going to have a career, so there's just not much point. He doesn't get any government grant funding. He hasn't since, I think, 1996. Yet he still goes to the lab every day and does research on cancer, not AIDS anymore, because there's no point with no money. But he was saying, he came up with what he called the multifactorial model, and a lot of that was the overuse of recreational and pharmaceutical drugs.
Right, and you know, I don't think the overuse of recreational drugs are probably good for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But Peter opened up the door to all kinds of possibilities of what was going on. And mm-hmm. I would say that Peter basically was making three major points. I think one was that HIV cannot be the cause of AIDS. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And two was it's not an infectious disease. And three was that, based on the fact that the science was not kosher or legitimate or, was all screwed up, the treatments were also very dangerous. So those are, I think, the three major points he was making. And no one gives Peter more praise than I do. But I agree with him on only two out of those three.
Right. And which one do you disagree with him on?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, I've written a book called The Duisbergians, and people can read it for free on my website, charlesortlib.com. And I write about Peter and four of his, I'll use the term loosely, followers, are people that were inspired by him.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to separate what I think are the brilliant criticisms that they all make, of the AIDS paradigm and what I think they've missed. And my argument with Peter is that the CDC's original epidemiology was based on garbage, and that what he's basing his theory on is their epidemiology, and if their epidemiology and i.e. their definition of the disease is wrong, we have to go back to the drawing board and look at everything. Freshly.
Right. So, what do you mean their epidemiology? Like the fact that it was supposedly a disease of gay men.
Yes. Right. Yes. That Peter basically said, no disease can just spread, among a behavioral risk group. There's no virus that says, oh, are you gay? Therefore, oh, let me infect you. Every which way he tries to say this, that's an absurd. It's an absurd correlation that they did not successfully prove. And my argument is that if they defined the disease too narrowly, that is the problem. That there was at that time, we now know, just sort of a major epidemic of immune dysfunction in the general population. And if you know the history of my paper, we spent the last decade focused on what I call the other part of the AIDS epidemic, which is the epidemic of what is called chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah, I just interviewed somebody on that who is an adherent to the, that at least viruses are part of the chronic fatigue syndrome.
Judy, you're talking about Judy Mikovits?
Yes,
Judy Mikovits. You know what I love about Judy is that she is out there referring to, I don't know whether she did this on your show or not, but she's out there referring to chronic fatigue syndrome. I think it's HIV negative AIDS.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that. I don't think she mentioned, I don't think she used that term on my show. I don't remember.
She's got guts to use that term, believe me. Because those are fighting words for the CDC and the NIH. Nothing scares them more than that concept, because it begins to raise the question, if there's HIV negative AIDS, is there really something called HIV positive AIDS, or what's going on here?
Yeah, the same thing actually occurs with polio. There's something called acute flaccid paralysis, which is the exact same symptoms as polio, but you can't detect the virus, and it's gone up to over 100,000 cases a year, according to the World Health Organization. And so if you say, okay, if you can have all the symptoms of polio without the virus, and we're only having maybe a couple hundred cases with the virus every year, like why is the virus so important?
Right. Well, I kind of look at this issue another way, which is, all right, if it isn't HIV, is it something else? Like, just because it isn't one virus doesn't mean it's not another virus. And that virus, in my mind, is probably a virus called HHV6. And as you may know, my name is practically synonymous with HHV6, and that stands for human herpes virus 6. And that virus was discovered by Robert Gallo, and I say discovered should be in quotes, because there's a question as to whether he really discovered this virus the same way he discovered HIV, which is that he lifted the work of another scientist.
Well, HDLV-1, which he called HIV-HDLV-3, HDLV-1 he discovered in concert with some Japanese scientists, and all of a sudden it was all Robert Gallo, and the Japanese scientists were kind of pushed to the side. So there's sort of a history of Robert Gallo acquiring viruses from other people.
I say he has in science what is known as sticky fingers.
Yes.
If you read John Crutzen's book...
Yes, I've read that, yes. Inventing AIDS.
Amazing book that was neglected by the media, and in some ways it got the same kind of treatment that that Duesberg got, in a way, because I think it was a threat to the hegemony of HIV, because the picture he painted of HIV, even though John Crutzen believes HIV is the cause, but if you read that book closely, the science was such a mess. I mean, John has these amazing anecdotes about how science was conducted in Robert Gallo's lab, and you know, and the top scientists in Gallo's lab who worked on HIV basically either didn't keep any records, or he kept them on little pieces of paper, and he didn't date them, and he would throw the little pieces of paper into a drawer.
Popovitz.
Yes, and it was a total mess. And, you know, and in order to reconstruct sort of the crime that Gallo's lab committed, you know, they had to do all this forensic work with, you know, these piles of paper from Popovic. And, you know, but no one, including Crutzen, seemed to ask, you know, if the science is that bad, what about the overall conclusion, you know, that this virus is really the cause? I mean, Gallo, they were sending out phony pictures of the virus, and meanwhile, you know, Gallo was powerful enough that he was able to control what was being published and what wasn't being published. I mean, it's amazing that John Crutzen didn't conclude at the end of the book that we need to rethink whether Peter Duesberg, you know, should be listened to.
Yeah, I couldn't believe after reading that book that Crutzen still was fervently solid HIV causes AIDS, even though I can't trust anything that Robert Gallo did, and his research is still foundational for the whole AIDS paradigm.
You know, I kept pressing this point to Crutzen. By the way, I have a bone to pick with John Crutzen, which is that my paper did numerous stories raising questions about Gallo.
Mm.
And I think there's a footnote about my paper in his book, and I was calling Crutzen constantly with stuff, and you know, and he just completely, you know, sort of wrote the native out of the whole history of Gallo.
Interesting.
You know, but I didn't make a big deal of that, because I was just happy that John Crutzen wrote that book, because I thought, you know, we need to have this record of what really, you know, really went on in Gallo's lab. I think that John felt like that he had done so much work to understand the esoteric science of HIV, that he just couldn't believe that he did that much work on something that wasn't the cause. And the other thing was, and this is kind of interesting, he also implied to me that the person that he trusted the most was Donald Francis, okay?
Right. I was going to say earlier, Donald Francis is the good guy, Robert Gallo's the bad guy.
Right,
but you're saying Donald Francis wasn't perfect.
Right. Donald Francis was his source, okay? But, you know, I talked to John in the last year, and mm-hmm. he does not speak highly anymore of Don Francis. So I wish he would, like, reconsider his whole book, you know, based on that.
For the record, the book is called Science Fictions with a subtitle something like The Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo.
Yes.
And I read it, and I really wanted to read it, and I really wanted to like it, but I found it very difficult because everything is a timeline, and the timeline was not clear in the book. Like, pages would go by without mentioning a date, and it's almost like on the side of every page of the book, I want to know where March 1984. I want that written on the side of the book so I know where I am. I just kept getting lost about what happened before or after something else, because it's like a murder mystery. You need to know who did what before the next thing happened, right? Because...
Well, I know a couple of people that own the book and have not read it. I mean, it's not an easy book to read.
No, it's not easy, yeah.
But I keep telling them, I said, the book is hilarious. I said, you've got to read it just because Gallo is so funny. I mean, Gallo, I mean, in the sense that he is this, like, he's the sitcom character. He's like, he's so, you know, he does such wild things. He's... You know, he says such crazy. He's a little bit like the Trump of science in that sense.
That's a good analogy. Yeah, he's kind of a bully who's got a long way by just making shit up on the moment.
And he gets away with murder.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
You know, I mean, it's amazing what he's gotten away with. I think, you know, the person that should make the Gallo movie may be Oliver Stone. I mean, is and I'm sorry that he's dead, but. He would have been a great Gallo. Gene Wilder, I always said, get Gene Wilder to play him.
Yes.
It reminded me a little of him. You know, I actually talked to Gallo on the phone a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
And I remember we did a cover of The Native, and the headline was, Should Gallo and Essex Be in Jail? Okay?
Right.
And that was, like, really early on. And it really shocked New York City, because no one could believe that this gay newspaper was talking about the most powerful, you know, AIDS scientist this way. And but I actually got Gallo on the phone, you know, after that issue appeared. And the first thing Gallo said to me was, "Mr. Ortlieb, you've made the mistake of a lifetime." and then we talked, you know, for like an hour or something like that, and I was taking notes. And what's really interesting about Gallo is that even when he's annoyed with you, he's still always trying to cajole you and make he always wants to make everyone his friend, you know.
Before he stabs you in the back.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Right. And, like, he wants you to like him,
yes.
But whether he likes you is purely of the moment.
Right.
You know, it's like Donald Trump with, like, Fox News, right? He loves Fox News, but if Fox News, you know, to save their reputation... does something negative, then he hates them, right?
Right.
It's totally up to him.
At one point, I had a friend in Boston who was a scientist named John Beldecas, and he was at Boston University. And he was involved at an AIDS conference that Gallo attended, and he attended a luncheon, and he was either by Gallo or, I mean, I think he was at the same table, but it was near enough to Gallo to hear Gallo refer to gay people as fags.
Really?
Yeah. And and then it was really over for me, you know, with Robert Gallo. I thought, okay, that now I know what we're really dealing with here.
Well, I've often wondered about some of the early AIDS scientists getting involved with a disease that was perceived at first of being purely gay. Like, did they hate gay men? Were they secretly gay, or was this just pure science, completely divorced from why people are getting sick?
I don't believe in pure science. In fact, I've written a book called Yatra Genocide, Notes for Political Philosophy of Epidemiology and Science. And what it is a collection of my notes from the last 10 or 15 years. And I try to make the case through a whole series of aphorisms, basically, that science is extremely political, and that AIDS science is extremely political, and it's what I call homodemiology. What is homodemiology? Homodemiology is epidemiology that is wired with heterosexism.
Mm-hmm.
And I make the case that the whole AIDS paradigm is the homodemiological paradigm. It's a heterosexist paradigm that basically is scapegoating the gay community for something that is happening to the general population.
Well, I'm going to talk at a conference on law and morality. I'm going to talk about the criminalization of HIV, and I think my first slide is going to be AIDS and morality, because the risk group, according to the CDC, are gay men, IV drug users, and black-skinned people. And those groups all carry a moral burden. I know, you know, politically correct people don't believe, you know, what Breitbart publishes about black crime. But there's still a very deep feeling in society that black people are naturally criminal, that they're naturally sexually insatiable. And, you know, it sort of parallels society's beliefs about gay men.
I wrote a novella about the racial politics of AIDS. Mm-hmm. It's called The Closing Argument, and it's very short. But it's the closing argument of a case in which a lawyer defends a black man who's accused of spreading AIDS to a white woman.
Right.
And what he tries to do is to educate the jury that the government is basically scapegoating black men and gays for an immunological problem that the whole country is facing.
Mm-hmm.
And what he tries to explain how if you're white and you have immune dysfunction, you're told you have chronic fatigue syndrome. And if you're black and you have immune dysfunction or gay, you end up being told you have AIDS. You know, and that's sort of the criminal part of the bus. But the other part of the bus, which is even bigger, are all the people in the country right now who are suffering from immune dysfunction. And, you know, and it's my contention that in order to really see the real epidemic, you have to tear down the wall between AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome, that there's a kind of apartheid, an immunological apartheid that's purely political going on.
Yes, and the definitions help that. I mean, one of the things I learned many years ago was that on an HIV testing forum, they include the risk group. So they know if you're gay, they know if you're black, they know if you're an IV drug user, and that helps them decide whether you're positive or negative. Well, you shouldn't need that if the test is science. You know, you put the blood through the test and it comes up positive or negative. Why do you need to know that the person's gay or not?
Right, just putting your finger on the scale or something.
Yeah, I guess. There's three dates in AIDS that seem to be very significant. 81, when, you know, the first report came out. 84, when Gallo announced the probable cause of AIDS as being discovered. And then 87, when AZT came out. And you were very much involved with that, like with John Lauritsen's articles, and I don't know what else you published that was related to AZT, but can you describe a little bit about how you got some concerns about AZT and what you think it did to your community?
Well, John has an eagle eye for detail, and mm-hmm. he just tore apart those studies and revealed how much fraud was involved in it, and it was amazing. But the problem was that the community didn't want to hear it.
Mm.
You know, and one of the people, by the way, who was a real villain in all of this, and he's considered to be the great hero of the AIDS epidemic, is my good friend, Larry Kramer. I take part of the responsibility for creating Larry Kramer in terms of AIDS, because I published a very famous piece that he wrote. I don't know whether you're aware of this piece or not, but it's called something like 1012 and Counting. And Larry wrote it kind of at the peak of the terror, you know, when everyone was scared and not a lot was happening, and a lot of people were still in denial that the epidemic was even happening. And he called me up. We had lunch, and he showed me the piece, and I read it, and I said, "Well, it's going to be on the front page of the paper on Monday." And I put it on the front page. And if you look at Wikipedia, which is terrible, on the New York Native, the one thing they do give us credit for was publishing this piece, which galvanized the community, and for better or worse, launched the so-called modern AIDS activist movement. But, you know, Larry throughout the epidemic has been a real Pied Piper. But he has also played a role in silencing critics, and he eventually turned against me and the Native. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he...
But you still referred to him as a friend.
I was kidding. I mean,
I do not mean that. I didn't catch the sarcasm.
You know, I mean, believe me. You know, and I'm sure the feeling is mutual. Mm. And, you know, I'm amazed that no one has written, you know, a book about Larry, because some of the stuff, the Larry Kramer paper trail, some of the things he said are just off the wall over the years. And I think everyone's afraid of him in the gay community. He's become like the Mother Teresa of the gay community.
But well, not afraid for what he'll do, but if he turns a saint.
You don't dare attack a saint.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know what I mean. And even more important in the gay community than being a saint is he's been associated with Emmy award-winning TV shows. You know,
right?
I mean, he's a celebrity, for God's sake.
So he has a huge amount of power, and he doesn't need to be brutal like maybe Gallo can be to get you to disappear.
Right. Although he can be very brutal. I mean, mm-hmm. a lot of people who know him are terrified of him. I mean, he turns on friends, you know, on a dime. He's a fascinating character, and someone needs to do a real movie, you know, about Larry and show the dark side and show the disaster he's helped create. I mean, he's very responsible for this mess.
For AZT?
Well, when I say this mess, I mean everything from AZT to Truvada.
Right. Yeah, the prep thing, which is also something we've covered. I don't know if you know Terry Michael, who's a gay man and journalist in Washington, D.C., who only found out about AIDS, about questions about AIDS maybe 10 years ago, but he's done some good stuff, and he's tried to cover this whole thing of PrEP, of putting healthy gay men on permanent drug therapy.
I mean, this is crazy. I mean, it's terrifying. It's, you know, I use the term Holocaust too to describe mm-hmm. this, okay? And I know that will drive a lot of people crazy. And why do I call Holocaust II? Because for gay people, Holocaust I was Nazi Germany, okay? But Holocaust II for me is an epidemiological Holocaust in which gay people have been deceived by the CDC about what's really going on. And many people have died because of the deception, and many more people are going to be harmed because of the ongoing deception, you know, until the gay community wakes up to what's really going on.
I mean, do you... let's talk about AZT a little longer. I mean, AZT is a nucleoside analog. It interferes with DNA synthesis. GlaxoSmithKline, I guess it was Burroughs Wellcome back then, sort of found it on a shelf, and it was free, basically. And they were able to patent it as an AIDS drug, a drug that in the very label says it's difficult to distinguish the side effects of this drug from the progression of AIDS.
Right.
In other words, it can cause AIDS.
Right.
Which isn't surprising since it interferes with DNA synthesis, therefore it stops your immune system from dividing, and your immune system needs to divide to live.
No, and a lot of people died because they were given high doses.
1,500 milligrams a day.
Right. And, you know, if there's any justice, you know, maybe there'll be some kind of class action lawsuit, you know, someday. I'm hoping, by the way, that all of this ends up in class action lawsuits. In fact, there's a philanthropist in San Francisco that you probably know named Bob Lepo. And
Yes, I know Bob Lepo.
And Bob Lepo has financed a lot of the AIDS dissent. And mm-hmm. What I would like him to do is to finance a conference on AIDS and class action lawsuits and just have this big think tank in Washington and bring all the top class action lawsuit people in and just go over all the potential atrocities that have happened over the last 30 years.
And all the different ways you could sue. Like, I mean, people I know have been harmed by the HIV theory are all the people who were sent to jail, all the mothers who were poisoned or had their children poisoned or had their children taken from them, Of course, all the gay men who were persuaded to go on AZT. And I think also all the gay men who were never really informed the paupers were dangerous.
Well, and there's also a silent majority that's suffering. And let me tell you who that silent majority is. And this is from my perspective, which people can find out more about it, you know, by reading Truth to Power. From my perspective, the, you know, what we're talking about is the tip of an iceberg, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's at the bottom of the iceberg? I'll tell you. The bottom of the iceberg are all the people with illnesses related to the chronic fatigue syndrome epidemic. And they're your allies. I mean, they're the allies of the AIDS dissidents. And these two groups need to start working together because, and I work both sides of this fence, of this political fence, mm-hmm. because I know a lot of people in the chronic fatigue syndrome community. And believe me, they are suffering. They are sick. and they know they have something related to AIDS. Even when they don't like to use the word or to think in terms of it being one epidemic, and they don't use political terms like apartheid like I use, you know, right. They know they have something that is as serious as AIDS, you know. And believe me, there are millions of them. And there are many of who have other members of their family who are sick too. And they're the other people that need to get involved in AIDS dissidents.
Right, because it's very easy to say, you know, AIDS by definition is kind of compartmentalized. Black people, especially black men, gay men, IV drug users, and of course, if you got a black gay IV drug user, you got the whole package, right?
Right.
And it's very easy for a lot of people in America to say, well, I'm none of those things, so it could never possibly hurt me. Although, I mean, I guess there's many ways to become immune suppressed. You can overuse antibiotics. Also, another thing I think that AIDS has brought to us, I don't know what you think about within the gay community, is a fear of sex, because sex can kill you, according to the AIDS theory.
Right.
And do you feel that, you know, attitudes in the gay community towards sex have changed in a negative way since 1981, when this supposedly deadly sexually transmitted virus was blamed for all the ills of the gay community?
Oh, the gay community has been harmed in so many ways, culturally, sexually, I mean, emotionally. And you know what? It's not over yet. I believe a time is coming when the gay community is going to have to wake up to the fact that they've been bamboozled. That they've basically been the CDC's patsies for, you know, 3.5 decades, and that
they're a machine to generate money. I mean, one of the funny things about AIDS is that nobody pays for their own drugs, and that's seen as, you know, especially in the United States, where you're on your own when it comes to healthcare. This is seen as an area where the United States is very charitable. But the fact is, if you want to, I think the newer combinations of AIDS drugs are now about $30,000 a year, and that doesn't cover all the other costs of being HIV positive, all the liver testing, and all the other things that you might need. So who could afford?
Yeah, it would be one thing if it was all based on legitimate science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, then you'd say, all right, whatever. But what if it's based on fraud?
Right.
You know, I mean, what if, you know, that this whole epidemic has been a lie from the very beginning? And, you know, I compare a lot of this to Madoff's Ponzi scheme. In fact, I've called Tony Fauci the Bernie Madoff of AIDS.
Yes, okay.
And the reason I do is, and I've seen both of the Bernie Madoff movies, is, you know, you look at all the people that were around him, and you look at the authorities that were supposed to, like, audit him and stuff like that. And when you think that he got away with that for so long, you're just amazed, you know. And I say, well, that's what has happened in AIDS. And that's also why Tony Fauci will not leave that job, by the way. You know, I think, what is he, 75 now?
And, all right.
And And he, I mean, he is, he needs to stay there because the minute he leaves, I think he's probably terrified that, you know, he'll lose control. And believe me, he has long, I call him a short man with long arms. I mean, he controls science like no one else in the world when you consider his budget. And by the way, I have talked myself to Terry Michael, and he told me that, like, Tony Fauci is one of the top three highest paid people in the federal government. So he's done very well for himself.
Yes, but as you say, it's kind of a two-way street because it's like the golden handcuffs. If he loses, they might find some stainless steel handcuffs for him if he leaves.
Right.
And so, I mean, it's like a Ponzi scheme, right? You can't say, okay, I've made millions with my Ponzi scheme, now I'm quitting, because then you're going to jail, right? So unless you can find a way to go to a country which doesn't have an extradition treaty and you don't mind leaving everybody behind that you've spent your life with, so you kind of get trapped into, I got to keep it going, but you know it can't go forever.
Right, and in, you know, in the Ponzi scheme, you keep, you know, giving out new dividends, throwing, mm-hmm. you know, good money after bad or something like that. But with a scientific Ponzi scheme, is you constantly have breakthroughs. And do you notice that there's just one positive development after another? You know what I mean? We think we have a vaccine, you know, and then, you know, 6 months later, no, now we really think we have a vaccine.
You know M.C. Escher?
Yes.
I always think of his staircases, right? You're going up and up and up and up and up and up, and then you realize you've gone around 10 times and you're still at the same level, but you feel like you're going up all the time.
And the secret to positive information constantly flowing out of the establishment and or dividends, you know, out of a Ponzi scheme is the control of information, mm-hmm. making sure that no one looks at the books. And what Fauci did early on was, you know, was to punish Duesberg and make him basically an example to the rest of the scientific community that, you know, if you dare question this, this is what's going to happen to you.
And New York Native was made an example. I mean, how did they shut down your newspaper around 97?
Well, I mean, they didn't shut it down, but they voted to boycott us. But in addition to that, and they tried to get people to stop advertising. But in addition to that, there was kind of a street thuggery that was happening too, which is, you know, by the time, in the year before we went out of business, we were giving away papers because, in fact, you know, most papers were transitioning to that kind of thing anyway. So people would be able to pick up a paper at a bar,
right.
You know, people would find, you know, piles of our newspapers thrown in the garbage. So, we kept up a good fight for a long time, but finally we couldn't sustain it, and that was that. And, so that was 20 years ago.
Yeah, so if you lose your advertisers, I mean, it's kind of ironic that all newspapers have experienced the same thing, but on a much slower scale. I mean, basically classified ads don't exist anymore, which was a huge moneymaker for newspapers. But when there's a boycott, of course, that happens over months as opposed to decades.
Yeah, and they did not want investigative reporting. They wanted, they wanted the gay community to get in line and to believe everything that the establishment, you know, was saying. You know, when you think of activist groups, they're usually opposing the government in some ways.
Yes.
But ACT UP is like an arm of the government. I mean, there's not, they're getting pharmaceutical money. They're like, you know, they're having meetings with Tony Fauci. I mean, it's a totally Potemkin village of activism.
Right. Well, it's like when they threw fake blood at a trade show on the booth of a drug company. I mean, they were actually helping to advertise the drugs. They're basically saying these drugs are life-saving, you need to make them cheaper, which is a pretty weak criticism. It's not like these drugs haven't been proven to improve your health, and they're highly toxic, and people are dying. Right? That would be something worth throwing fake blood for. But it was almost like it was kind of one of these inverse advertising campaigns, or when the mother says to the child, you're going to hate this broccoli. Only adults like broccoli, in the hopes that the child will want to eat broccoli.
Right. And there was this whole, like, sort of anti-intellectual kind of thing happening in the gay community. Like, you know, in so far as they, you know, went after John Lauritzen, and, you know, who is really smart and really, you know, did the analytical work necessary to understand what was wrong with AZT.
Right.
You know, and they just didn't want to hear it, and they wanted to silence him and silence the native. And, you know, and I think, you know, the message got out to all the other publications that, you know, you better watch it. And on the other hand, the other publications were all taking full-page ads for AZT and, you know, whatever, for all, you know.
Yeah, and I remember they also had full-page ads for whatever that, I can't remember the name of it, but it's something that stimulates your blood supply to produce more blood. And it says, you know, specifically recommended for AZT patients, admitting that AZT causes serious anemia. So I can never pronounce it, erythropoietin or something.
Right.
You know, it's just an admission in glossy, on a glossy back page of a journal saying you need, you know, if you got AZT, it's going to kill your blood supplies. So you need to take this other drug to sustain your blood for a little bit longer, and you might live a little bit longer.
You know, and there are all kinds of, like, ads promoting, you know, the whole agenda.
Right.
You know,
we've come close to the end of our time, so I'm just wondering if there's anything you'd like to say to kind of wrap up our discussion, anything that you really wanted to get out that we haven't.
Just if people want to know more about what I think, they just need to go to Charles Ortleb, ORTLEB.com, and they'll find information about my books, and they'll find a couple of free books they can read right there online, and there will be more to come. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk about all this.
Yeah, well, I've wanted to interview you for a long time, and it was only fortuitous that recently we got in touch through Gary Nell, who my radio show goes on, Gary Nell's network, so I'm glad that happened. I will put charlesortleb.com in the show notes, so if people have trouble spelling it, they can just go to the website for the podcast to get a direct link. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, David.
I hope maybe we can talk again sometime in the future.
Yes, let's do it again. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to episode 149 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @InfectiousMyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/InfectiousMyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.